Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum.
End of message. Doesn't matter unless you're a fully qualified water company, you bastard. Day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 169 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
What's been happening since last we assembled? Let's start with the latest set reports. We've seen who the classic monsters are that RTD is bringing back, haven't we? It's the Ogrons.
What?
Were you not aware of this?
No.
Have you not seen the photos that were recently shared on social media showing a pair of knuckle-dragging Neanderthal gorillas spotted near that concrete staircase on the South Bank?
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Doc.
And I hear that just like the Galtecs in the Suntaran experiment, they've chosen to distinguish the Ogrons by having them deliver their lines in some very dodgy colonial accents.
Would you be referring at all to my dinner catch up with lunch catch up with David Kitchen?
Oh, it was you two. Right.
No, I mean, do you know what? We ran into a few Draconians, but of course you're going to find that along the South Bank, aren't you? So,
Hayden, changing the subject completely, you've met one of our podcasting colleagues, didn't you, recently?
Yeah. Good old friend of the show, Dave Kitchen, came into London and we met up and had a drink, had a look at some Frontier in Space location. It's basically that staircase that you're basically referring to, Doc, isn't it? We're the Ogrons. That's the joke, isn't it? I've got no comeback. All I can say is there were no complications in the day.
It's a good job I was up in Manchester that weekend, because if you'd said, oh, let's just walk across the river to the South Bank, I'd have said, get lost. How young do you think I am? Did you get anywhere interesting, like the Fitzroy Tavern or anywhere? Or
We met at the BFI on the South Bank.
Oh, right.
Because David had never been there before, so I showed him around, and we went to the restaurant there and had lunch and had a couple of drinks. And it was really nice, really pleasant. Good chat. God, we spent a few hours there, actually, thinking about it. Really good, yeah. Really nice to see him again. Because, of course, the last time we saw him was at, like you said, the Fitzroy Tavern, which is obviously outside the post office tower, looms large over the Fitzroy Tavern. So
yeah, and that was 5 years ago.
I know. It's insane, isn't it?
Wasn't 5 years how long it took you to get there, Mark?
Yeah, because they had a replacement bus service that day. So the trains weren't working because they were doing engineering works on the line. And just as the bus was leaving the local train station, it had gone about 10 feet before it smacked straight into a bollard. And the coach had to be emptied and we all had to wait for another coach to turn up. So that added about 45 minutes to the journey.
Good grief. Was the bus driver Mr. Magoo by any chance?
He seemed to be giggling a lot and saying, oh, don't worry, you're all economy passengers anyway.
Anything else been happening, Doctor Who-wise, with us?
I went to a museum in Stansted called the House on the Hill Toy Museum.
Oh, yes, yeah.
We went for our anniversary. We had to do something that was kid-friendly. Not for my son, but for me, obviously. inside the actual... Well, it's a brilliant place. Love it, because it's... half of it is an Anglo-Saxon village. And they've got lots of wildlife just roaming around mock-ups of what the village and the castle in Stansted would have looked like years and years and years ago. In fact, actually, The Apprentice did a bit of filming there a few seasons back. And yeah, so it's a fairly well-known area. And they've also got like a dinosaur walkway and all the rest of it. But anyway, the main attraction, obviously, is the toy museum. And there's a little area there where they've got two Daleks and a TARDIS. And my son was very excited. He's not really taken that much of an interest in Doctor Who so far. But when he saw the Daleks, he was pointing very excitedly at them. And Sophie managed to get that moment encapsulated in a photograph. So, brilliant. And he was standing next to the... Well, we're standing in the photo next to the two Dalek film posters, which is rather apposite in our last episode. And then as you walk up the stairs, it's got like a motion sensor. So as you start walking up the stairs, the countdown from Thunderbirds starts, and William is absolutely obsessed with Thunderbirds right now.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say, how did you react to the giant Thunderbirds 2? Thunderbird 2, rather.
Yeah, he absolutely loved it and saw the toys in the display cabinets. And they had a lot of stuff in there, but I did feel as though, I know it's a museum of sorts, but there's a very definite cut-off point, which is very much early to mid-90s. Like, I saw some of my Thunderbird and Captain Scarlet and Stingray stuff in there, but it sort of stops about mid-90s.
Or as Mark and I called them, the olden days.
No, yesterday, isn't it? The 90s? Yesterday.
I was about to say it's nearly 30 years ago, isn't it? So it's...
Yeah, well, it is.
I said to Sophie, the toys that I saved for William from my childhood, after he's grown out of them, or, you know, we have any children who might not be interested later on in life, then might as well just give them to that museum, donate them. But there we go. It's it was wonderful. It was wonderful.
Do you know where the Daleks came from? Were they just fan-made replicas?
I think they were fan-made, to be honest with you. I don't know, because it was... they weren't screen accurate. But they were great. I mean, they had two TARDISes there. There was one just outside the main entrance. They had one of the prop stationary three-wheeled vans from Only Fools and Horses that was just used for sort of like long shots and that sort of thing.
All right.
They had so much Dad's Army paraphernalia, and they had some of the autographs from the Carry On cast. So it's like Kenneth Williams' autograph was there, a lot of the Bond stuff too. A lot of penny machines from like the 30s onwards. Just brilliant place, love it. Absolutely love it. Last time me and Sophie went was about 4 or 5 years back. So it was nice to take William and him to appreciate it. And he loved feeding the animals as well. So, lovely day out.
So whereabouts was this again?
It's called the House on the Hill Toy Museum. And it's in Stansted.
Oh, near the airport?
Yeah.
Right. Well, links as ever in our show notes, Faith Assessors, that's diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. You up to anything Doctor Who-wise, Mark?
I've been indulging in I've been indulging my love of comics lately.
Oh, right.
With Cutaway Comics, who are an independent comics publisher run by Gareth Kavanagh, who does Vought magazine.
Oh, of course, yes.
And obviously who we saw recently at the Capitol. And Deskin as well is involved. A little while ago, they published a comic from the world of BBC TV's Doctor Who, Omega, written by Mark Griffiths.
Of course,
and artwork by John Ridgway.
All right.
Who is the artist who is responsible for some of the, I think it's mostly the Sixth Doctor era comics back in the comic strip in DWM. Stuff like Voyager, you know, and he created, drew Frobisher and stuff. And
yeah.
That era of Doctor Who. And also he used to draw for 2000 AD as well and drew a brilliant comic strip called Summer Magic. I can't, off the top of my head, remember who wrote that, but featured a young lad who... And had something to do with a werewolf, and it was very mystical and weird and brilliant and quite unlike a lot of other stuff that they have in 2000 AD.
With Alan McKenzie.
Okay, right.
A Journal of Luke Kirby with Alan McKenzie.
Yeah, that's right, Luke Kirby.
Summer
that's
Magic, right. Yeah, 1988.
Anyway, so John Ridgway is someone whose artwork I've long been a fan of, and I can't believe he's still producing artwork this good? He's over 80 years old. What I brought is the Omega Unplugged edition, which is basically it was originally released as a four-issue series, mini-series, and in colour. And the item that I purchased, the Unplugged one, is it's all in black and white, so you get to... I suppose aesthetically, it's very different. It feels like you get to see the artwork a bit clearer.
Okay.
And I do love it. And some of the artwork in is, it's got some very surreal stuff in there. There's some beautiful pages in here. And the story's really good as well. It seems to be something of a Brexit allegory.
Oh, God, we need more of them.
But yeah, it's great. It's really, really enjoyable. I highly recommend it. It's good. It's nice. It's a lovely thing to have if you're a fan of John Ridgway's work. And like I say, it's a good story.
Of course, he did Voyages the wrong way. He did that enormous waterfall, didn't he?
Yes, yeah. Going off the edge of the universe sort of thing.
The elephants and the World Shapers?
Yes, yeah. I believe he did, yes. Grant Morrison's one. With the Vord turning into the Cybermen.
I've not done much really Doctor Who related. I've seen a few more Bond films at my local cinema. The Living Daylights was interesting. Far more than I remember it being at the time.
It's great.
I've never seen it.
The weird thing is how they portray the Taliban as sort of chummy, rough diamonds.
Yes, they do.
When the Bond girl gallops after James to save him, the Taliban leader sort of rolls his eyes as if to say, "Women, what can you do?" I've always thought they had very decided ideas on what needs to be done with women. It was really bizarre. Well, Taliban, Mujahideen in those days, would you call them, wouldn't they?
I was just going to say, I was supposed to see The Living Daylights, but unfortunately the projector was broken. We were a bit stranded. We didn't have anything to see, so we went and saw Top Gun Maverick instead, which was amazing.
Really?
Yeah, really, really good. Really good. And then when we came out of the cinema, I got a call from my sister to say that my nephew had been born.
Oh.
Oh, of course, yes. What's he been called?
Louis.
We've had a sad time, haven't we, since the last podcast. We've lost Bernard Cribbins and David Warner and also Ian McLachlan.
Yes.
Who I think was a DWAS executive member for quite a few years. You know Ian Hayden?
Well, Ian was the guy who infamously introduced me to Terence Dix.
Ah.
And then infamously introduced me to another round of cider. And then infamously got me sloshed. The last time I saw Ian was at the, what was the name of that convention we went to in Rickmansworth?
Oh, Phantom Films.
The Phantom Films one, yeah. I can't remember what it was now, but that's the last time I saw Ian and sat down and had a chat with him. Ironically, I remember we spoke about Bond. Because I remember him telling me his favourite Bond was George Lazenby. So that was interesting.
Well, it's one of the best films.
It is. It is. If not the best.
Mm.
We'll leave that for Podcasters Royale. But it was...
Bertram has died just before we put out our last podcast, but I thought there's not much point in our going back and trying to re-record bits in it.
Yeah, well, I think we were quite... we were very complimentary and talked about his career on that anyway, so...
Yes, we did. We were talking about the two Dalek films, weren't we?
Mm-hmm.
Just another... one of the pillars of my childhood has fallen down.
He's a pillar of so many childhoods as well, because he's been there since, what was it, the 50s? Either on TV or film. I have to say, actually, one of his last TV shows that he made... Actually, no, it wasn't one of his last. He did it back in 2013, I think it was. It was a CBeebies series called Old Jack's Boat, where he plays an old sailor. And Premier Ashman's in the first series of it, but...
Yeah.
In commemoration of his passing... CBeebies have started showing Old Jack's Boat again now. So I'm able to show William. So we've been watching Old Jack's Boat.
Telling stories or something.
Yeah, with the dog Salty. Salty the dog. very Jackenorian-ized. Yeah.
So he was the most frequent ever Jackenori contributor, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Him and Kenneth Williams, wasn't it, the other one?
Do you want to know about laser beams, Mortimer? Said Arabelle.
Ark!
Said Mortimer. As far as he was concerned, Arabelle might as well have asked him if he wanted to know about the exports of methylated spirit from Westphalia. Mortimer wasn't in the least interested in laser beams. All he wanted to do was to annoy the horse, Katie Daly, so much that she would break into a gallop.
I declare I'm simply gasping for a cup of tea, said Her Majesty one day when it was getting 4:30.
He was in 2 Carry On films, I think, as well.
Yeah, he was definitely in Carry On. He was in Carry On Jack, and he was in the finest one, Carry On Spying. David Warner has been all over science fiction, hasn't he?
Yeah.
It's when you consider what he was. I think he was. It was certainly in the RSC, wasn't he? Let's have a look.
Yeah, he was a big influence on people like Patrick Stewart, apparently, as well, who of course starred alongside him in that Chain of Command episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Oh wow, that's. Yeah, that's quite a scary one, that one, isn't it? It's the Chain of Command.
There Are 4 Lights, it's that one, isn't it? 3 top 40 hits in 1962, we should add.
Who?
Bernard Cribbins.
Oh, David Warner.
Say David Warner.
I have to say, actually, one of my favourite David Warner moments was, do you remember when Mark Gatiss did a programme called The History of Horror?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Really, really good. Still on YouTube. Yeah. Links in the show notes, ladies and gents. And he's speaking to David Warner about his role in The Omen, because he's very famously decapitated by a sliding sheet of glass in it.
Mm.
And he asks him, did you ever keep the head?
Do you have any idea what happened to your severed head?
I lost it in the divorce.
I think he was in a relationship with Lisa Bowerman, wasn't he?
Billy
Summerfield. That was his. She was his partner.
I think I first came across him either possibly when he was playing Evil in Time Bandits.
Oh, I've never seen it.
Never seen Time Bandits?
No.
I should say that you've never seen Time Bandits. Sorry, the first way I said it, only dogs could really hear it.
You were almost so high-pitched you were Scouse. I thought Alan had come back.
Just broken all the glasses in the kitchen.
I've got it somewhere. That's the... it's like an offshoot of Python, isn't it, Time Bandits?
Mm. Oh, I can't... But that's got so many things that cross over with other fan stuff and genres that you're into. Like, that's... Yeah.
I've seen The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, if that makes you any better.
Mm. Oh, Time Bandits, though. I remember Time Bandits, we watched it at school in our video club that we had.
Oh, do you know? That's how I first saw it.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, after school, video club, one of the most exciting things ever. Loads of kids just go and sit in the hall and watch, or go and sit in one of the classrooms and watch a video for a couple of hours, quite possibly on Betamax.
Oh. I don't know. You podcast for 6 years and all of a sudden Time Bandits brings you to the realisation that you both went to school together. It's incredible.
They also showed Rocky, which was... I believe there was 2 fights broke out on the way home after it. It's really exciting, isn't it? Because we didn't have streaming and stuff back then. So for us to... And quite often, you know, some families wouldn't even have a video, so to watch something on a video was like quite exciting. So yeah, it's a big event.
So happy times.
Yeah, there was one other thing. Have you noticed the thing on social media about Cybus Industries?
No.
What's this?
There's a Twitter account been set up by Cybus Industries, which seems to feature... It's obviously promoting Doctor Who.
Cybus Industries at Cybus Indus.
Yes, that's it, yeah. It's basically like the Cybus company from the time of the Age of Steel, except it's happening in this universe right now, is what the conceit is. And so there's an account set up, which is obviously something to do with the official
Doctor
Who. Mm, yeah, definitely. Because they filmed... weird little videos as well that have codes and stuff hidden in them. For people to go scouring through, and the videos are usually backwards and stuff, or they have the music going backwards and things. It's really odd. I'm presuming that for the centenary, it's going to have something to do with the Cybermen.
Gosh, that's actually coming, isn't it, in within less than 2 months?
Yeah, the end of the Chibnall era. Sorry, the end of the Chibnall era. How will we cope?
Read that again, Mark. It actually reads the Chibnall era.
Sorry.
Yeah, I reckon that's something to do with it. But it's just, I don't know, publicity for me. You can be clever with it, but you also need to be quite explicit with it to get bums on seats to be watching it.
I mean, the fact that you two Doctor Who fans hadn't seen this suggests that it's not cut through quite as much as they hoped it would. I mean, there's things like, do you remember the Are You Beach Body Ready adverts that they used to have showing a woman in a bikini? And they used to have these adverts on the London Underground.
Great big posters.
They've done a version of that, except that it's not a woman. It's a Cyberman with some yellow Speedos on.
For Christ's sake.
But, you know, they're trying. At least they're actually doing something.
Have you ever watched a sunset, ate a well-prepared meal, wore a pair of budgie smugglers?
The London Underground.
These things are comfy.
Doctor Who fans have brought Cybus Industries to life in mock campaign. Cybus Industries is a new Twitter account that's cropped up, putting Cybermen into our world, whether that's through photoshopped Metro ads or fake news articles. And it's doing all this while poking fun at British and sometimes American politics.
Oh, is it really? Is it, they say it's absolutely definitely not to do with the show then?
Doesn't say so.
Okay, but I'm just wondering what all the code stuff is and things. And they actually take you through to proper websites if you get the codes and stuff.
I suppose they might have got it wrong.
I mean, I don't know. It just looks a little bit too smoothly done.
Interesting.
I mean, I don't know. But then there's other things. Well, they keep going about Elon Magpie.
Elon Magpie.
Trying to buy out Cybus Industries. Because obviously Magpie with the other tech company, weren't they? In Doctor Who. Anyway, interesting. Interesting. It doesn't have a blue tick. So, who knows? Who knows?
Right, well, we thought that having delved into the depths as deep as Horns of Nymon in our time, we might as well go somewhere nearby and review Nightmare of Eden this week.
Well, look, let's be honest. We basically decided we'd review a story for this week's podcast, and we had to pick one of the ones that I managed to find in storage. As I mentioned last week, I've just moved house, and so I've just recently uncovered a small cache of Doctor Who DVDs.
Mark sent us a photo of the pile of DVDs he'd found, and the one on top, I think, was Nightmares, so we went for it. As shocking as it may seem to you, listeners, that is how we do our selection.
It's a little glimpse behind the curtain.
If you look really closely, though, at that list, it was just season 17 stories over and over again.
Photoshopped in over and over again. Oh god, I do love, well, have I ever mentioned how much I love season 17?
Too often. Who would like to start us off?
I don't mind. Shall I start off?
Yeah, go on, Mark.
Go on, Mark. I think you started off 9-1, didn't you?
Did I?
I think you did about 3 hours on how much you loved Nymon, and then Hayden and I just have, wiped it up afterwards. Fire away, Mark. Tell us why Nightmare of Eden is something we should all be watching.
Because it's brilliant. I watched it this afternoon, and it's always a delight. I mean, obviously, I am particularly drawn to season 17. I've got vague memories that go back to season 12. It was really season 17 where everything clicked in. I think I was 8 and 1979. Oh, Tom and Lala and K-9, one of my top Doctor Who teams, just adore them. And I think this story, I, Let's get the main criticism out of the way first. That'd be the budget, I think.
Mm.
I mean, this series... I mean, this isn't that far towards the end of the series, is it? It's a sort of middle of the series, really. Mm. I mean, Noimon is only last in the series because Shada got cancelled. But they were still managing to run out of money. And they clearly had hoped to save a lot of money by skimping on Nightmare of Eden, like shooting all the spaceship stuff on video for the first time as opposed to going into an actual film studio and spending days on it. They just shot it, you know, in a video suite in just under 3 hours. But as with Noimon, as with Invasion of the Dinosaurs, lots of them, the budgetary problems never spoil my enjoyment. The fact that it looks like some of the special effects are sort of on the same level as the Tomorrow People is not a compliment. You know, that really doesn't bother me. I absolutely love it because I just think this script is really funny. I don't know how much of that is down to Douglas Adams and how much of that is down to Bob Baker, but it's just a really funny script. I mean, it's odd because the subject of the story is drug running and how drugs wreck lives and how, in fact, the drug Vraxoin has wiped out whole planets and brought misery to billions and trillions of people across the galaxy, so much so that the only known source of it has been destroyed. And it's quite a dark subject, but there's so much fun to be had as well. I guess that's, the tone does clash a bit. It's just something, and I think Tom and Lala are absolutely superb in it. Their characters are just so good at this point. The interaction between each other, with Tom with his very sort of managing to be stern and funny at the same time and flippant. Mm. And it's really odd how he manages to do the two things almost in the same scene, like be incredibly funny and charming and yet also be incredibly stern and commanding. And Lala Ward is given some really heavy techno-babble dialogue and she delivers it perfectly. It's not like when, I say sometimes in the modern series, sometimes I see some actors are struggling with it. I think Matthew Waterhouse on the Behind the Sofa says that you can't act these lines. They're, you know, some of the lines that Romana's sort of having to spout. It's almost impossible. And yet she delivers it beautifully. She just delivers it with such confidence that you absolutely believe her. Even though you don't understand what she's saying, you believe that it means what it's supposed to mean. She's just great. It's just hilarious. Tom Baker's like, I don't work for anybody. I'm just having fun. It's just lovely. And Galactic Insurance went into liquidation 50 years ago. Oh, I wondered why I hadn't been paid. It's just really good. It's just Tom delivers these lines so beautifully.
I'm the doctor. I keep telling you that.
Yes, but who do you work for?
Work for? I didn't work for anybody. I'm just having fun.
And David Dacre as well. What a performance. He's great in this. He's great as Iron Bronn as well in The Time Warrior.
That's not him, is it?
Yeah.
No. Oh, my God.
His performance in this is just... I mean, I know we always talk about Philip Maddock and Kevin Stoney as like great Doctor Who guest stars, but I mean, David Dacre's surely got to be up there as well because his performance in this is just brilliant. You know, his business-like nature and stuff and very natural performance as Rig, the captain of the Empress, is nice. But then when he slips into the... when he has his drink spiked and he's off his mash on Vraxoin, that performance is great, isn't it? He's just...
off his mash?
It's an old brass eye thing. Sorry.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Have you got any Clarky cat, Mark?
Yeah, he's off his mash on ecstasy pipes.
Just to let you know, faithless sisters, that Mark is much more familiar with the Argo of the Demi-Monde than Hayden and I are.
But his giggling and stuff, his descent into just giggling. And it's, if you've... I'm pretty sure Hayden's seen people pretty wrecked. And I know I have. And
wow.
I'm not sure about Doc. He's had a much more cultured upbringing.
I've had a very sheltered upbringing.
But his performance as someone who's like really stoned and giggling is just, it's really good, isn't it, Hayden?
Yeah, he's sort of, he's on his third tube of Pringles by the point. He's sort of, the munchies are well and truly taken over by that point. Yeah.
What are they talking about, listeners?
even the scripting of his stone train of thought, that sort of like, oh, little ship in a big ship, and giggling at the thought of it, just like a ship in a bottle, and just like really laughing at that. That is very much what what I've seen people who are stoned act like.
This will teach me to take on new co-hosts without rigorous background checks.
Yeah.
Something should have told me that just asking, have you heard of Doctor Who, wasn't enough.
Yeah, it's just beautifully done. And that sudden, when he turns and he's on his come down, he's like, it's getting withdrawal. I mean, that's quite terrifying, really, as well. Mm. But it's, the acting's still great. I mean, it is a strange story in that it's really funny. And it's got some really funny bits in it, like intentionally funny, and some really good comedy in it. And like a lot of, I think, season 17 has this kind of, it does have that flippant comedy tone, but I don't think that undercuts the drama, although it does jar sometimes with some of the actual horror of what's going on the screen. Yeah, but David Dacre, Christ, is just one of my favourite guest star performances.
Ruined for me forever that moment by Pip Madeley's daily update of what is Captain Rigg laughing at today.
Oh!
That he kept putting up day on day on Twitter.
I've not seen this.
Was that the precursor to Mavellan's watching?
Yes, it was, yeah. It was.
I think this one has been before my time.
Doc, nothing's before your time.
Yes, I just love it. I love the concepts behind the story. I love the end of episode two when the Doctor and Romana skip through the screen together.
I do like that, yes.
Which is just a brilliant cliffhanger because you don't know what's going to happen. I've been trying to remember what that must have been like when I was 8, but I'm unable to remember. So it's something that I've always known.
Were you already stoned then, Mark?
I was off my mash on ecstasy, folks. It's such a lovely moment. And speaking of which, there's the bit as well, isn't there, where Romana's looking in. She just sees that face poking out from between the branches. And for ages, zooming in slowly, you can't tell at first what she's looking at, can you? And then it just suddenly starts coming into focus, the face and the eye, and you realise it's been there all the time. And that's just really extremely creepy.
I think one day, Hayden, we're going to have to do a podcast episode where we present Mark with the opportunity to review both Nightmare of Eden and Horns of Nymon. And at the end, he's got to choose which one to keep and which one is destroyed forever.
Oh, yes.
I'd rather do myself in.
That's the other reason why we did this one, listeners, is that our Horns of Nymon review was so extraordinarily popular with you all. We thought, let's try and find something that Mark loves where Hayden and I are quite likely to think, oh, that's a bit bobbins, isn't it? Hayden, have you flicked off the safety catch on your commentary revolver?
I can't imagine Hayden's got much to add to what I've already said.
Well.
Hey, excuse me, I've got a copyright on that. Heavy sigh, long pause.
Oh, sorry. Let me do my own version. Ugh. I'm not a fan of this era.
No? You've never mentioned it?
Mark's friend may claim that I'm not a fan of any era. I think, in all fairness, there's some good ideas here. And I also think that Bob Baker, I mean, this was the only Doctor Who story he ever wrote on his own.
Mm-hmm.
He does a fairly good job. But apart from the funny comedy lines that Mark's already outlined, I think tonally it's all over the place.
Hmm.
I think June Huntson's gimpy police uniforms are tacky beyond belief and detract. Oh no, they don't detract. They add to an already dazzling set and array of design work, which does detract in almost in a similar way that Warriors of the Deep detracts.
What is he saying, Mark? What is he saying?
Oh, I haven't started yet. I have a level of distrust for some Doctor Who fans, well, pretty much all of them, as a matter of fact, when it comes to their adulation of anything to do with Tom Baker in the series and their disdain of anything Colin Baker does in the series. Because recently I've been watching bits of season 22, Because yes, I did plump for that box set. There's very little to distinguish between both eras at this point, actually.
So 22 is Attack of the Cybermen to
Revelation of the Daleks, yeah.
So it's Collins' first season.
Yeah, it's all brightly lit. It's all looking fairly cheap. It's erratic performances. And I just don't understand why people give... And I'm not saying Mark in this instance, but why people will give season 17 a pass, but deride much of the Colin Baker era or into the 80s. It's still the same programme. It looks exactly the same. The only difference is obviously the leads at this point. And, okay, yeah, I suppose one of Graham Williams' last one. The saving grace of Nightmare of Eden was that Graham Williams' experience making this one was so harrowing that he decided to leave the series.
That's true.
But then again, that did lead to John Nathan Turner, which is divisive also.
There's a little near the knuckle, given that I'm recording in my bedroom this week, that Hayden is just saying, oh, it's just brightly lit, cheap, and full of erratic performances.
Oh, sorry, I was just reading one of the iTunes reviews of our podcast there. I do apologise. But there's enough creation within the script, and there's enough talent on screen to make it just about passable for me, this. But ooh. I'm not a big fan. It's just not... I don't think this is a strong era. I think it's so entrenched in fans' minds. For one of the reasons being is that it's Tom Baker and seems to be with a lot of people. Whatever he does, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't do anything wrong, which is rubbish. He does. And he does something quite wrong in this that I didn't find at all funny.
What was that?
The, oh, my arms, my legs.
Oh, right, okay. Oh. Yeah, I think the problem with that is that's recorded later as well, isn't it? That's, what do they call that when they do that? Sorry.
Oh, was it post,
Isn't there an A something? It's like ASM or something. I can't remember what it is.
Yeah, additional dialogue recording, ADR.
ADR, thank you.
Oh, I didn't realise that. That's not just him ad-libbing and being allowed to get away with it. Actually deliberately...
dropping that in afterwards. I'm pretty sure of it.
Yeah.
I've just realised, talking about, by the way, that no one has given us an iTunes review since the 20th of December 2020. Get on with it, listeners, please.
Lordy. where was I? That's it, yeah. Fans seem to be so forgiving of everything Tom Baker does in the show. But even he's crap on occasion. And I thought he was in that instance. It was just, it's so erratic by this point. And fans also seem to love Lala Ward's portrayal of Romana, but hate characters like Clara, let's say, Jenna Coleman's Clara, when Romana's just as stuck up and annoying on occasion as Clara used to be. And it just, it boils my nerdy, well, it grinds my nerdy gears that season 17 is given a pass when things like season 22, which I think is of equal standard... Which is, okay, fairly low, let's in my understanding. But it really annoys me how the reputation of one or two people can just almost sort of gloss over everything else. Because I don't think Tom Baker's that brilliant in this.
Oh,
I think season 17, for me, is probably the first season where I look at it and think someone else could probably be the Doctor at this point. Everything about the series is starting to look a little past its best, I think, with this time.
Well, I mean, I think certainly some of the budgetary stuff is difficult. Obviously, the show's struggling. But I can't agree with you about Tom Baker. I think he's excellent in this. Not every moment that he does is brilliant. His performance can be, I wouldn't say erratic, because I think most of it, I'd still say 95% of it's way, way above average. But I would agree that there are times like the, my fingers, my arms, my legs, my everything. Yeah, that's not great. But, is that an ad lib or is that in the script? I don't know.
It's interesting, isn't it, that I think... You see, I mean, you all know that Tom is out on his own for me as my Doctor. But I really see City of Death as his last hurrah. From when on, although I can enjoy him, I mean, things like Full Circle, I think, are quite successful. Keeper of Charkham, when he's in being on his own with Matthew. But there's a lot of it that I can take or leave, really, from then on. After City of Death, Full Circle is probably the only one that I could regularly rewatch and not think, oh God, this is going to be a bit of a chore. So I'm not one of those who will say everything Tom does is brilliant.
Yeah.
And everything Colin does is bobbins. It's more that, say, 75% of what Tom does is great and everything that Colin does is rubbish. And I don't know what it is. I mean, he did three series, didn't he, Graham Williams?
Yeah.
Horror Fangrock's Invasion of Time. Some good stuff in there. Horror Fangrock's great. Image of the Fendahl.
Yeah, but everything after Horror of Fangrock, The Invisible Enemy, and Image of the Fendahl are Robert Holmes and Philip Hinchcliffe commissioned scripts.
That's true, yes.
And the other three are not.
I do hate making arguments, forgetting that Hayden's probably read up on this. Key to Time, the good episodes, stories in that tend to sort of hold the others together, don't they? Because it's really a single story. But to me, Power of Crawl and Armageddon Factor are dreadful. And then Destiny's rubbish. Creature from the Pit is quite dreadful. But I quite liked Nightmare of Eden. It's one of those ones that you think, that was quite fun, but I've never watched it again. I mean, first of all, let's deal with one of the worst elements of this era. The TARDIS is absolutely filthy.
Yes.
I'm kind of just giving it a lick of paint. There is a lot of interest. I think for me, it's not that there's anything particularly fascinating, but there's enough variety of stuff going on to entertain you. There's the CET machine. There's the drugs issue. There's the separating the ships issue. There's the slight mystery of what happened to Stott. I think as we've all hinted at this week without actually saying it, it's very... The CET machine is very Carnival of Monsters, isn't it? Because if you think about it, the Doctor is disapproving of two things here, isn't he? Oh, yes, here, this is the story that's the big philippic against drugs. But really, he's almost more disapproving of the CET machine than the drugs, Tom, isn't he? I mean, he disapproves of drugs in the sense of, millions and millions of people getting their lives destroyed. But it seems to be a more personal grudge for him against the machine, given that it's a science issue, you know, a scientist doing this. But I loved it. I mean, I much prefer the CET machine to the miniscope personally. I love the switch from world to world with just a switch of things. And to get into it, you don't have to crawl in under a flap and work your way through some very unconvincing large clockwork machinery. I think Doctor and Romana work quite well. I could do without that silly dress that Romana's wearing.
Yeah, it's not the greatest outfit, is it?
And I have mixed feelings about the performance of Louis Fayandar from Trist. As Trist, rather. I think if this was a story that I was taking really seriously, then I would probably be annoyed by it. But given that it's something where I'm actively trying to find things to keep me interested, in a way, it's one of the things I think keeps me on board. Great, sort of great scenery-chewing performance, which gives him, as I think we've mentioned before, the opportunity for Tom to go toe-to-toe with someone who clearly is getting a bit of a kick out of performing alongside them. Because if he was more serious, everyone else, with the possible exception of David Dacre's rig, they're a bit vapid, aren't they? And I'm not sure how his outrageous German accent works with the payoff at the end. I think you can argue that he's very similar to Sol Deed, in that both characters are being massively overacted. But at least you can argue that Sol Deed's over-the-top character possibly comes out of insanity or over-ambition. At the end of the day, Trist is really just a bit silly, isn't he? And I think the problem is that if Louis Fayandar had played him seriously, it might have made the story a lot duller.
Yes.
Without actually contributing much to it. Interestingly, it was Bob Baker and Dave Martin wrote a story for Target, didn't they? I mean, the TV series Target, about drug smuggling. I think it was called Big Elephant, which, interestingly, starred Katie Manning as a drug addict. Directed by Dougie Camfield and produced by Philip Hinchcliffe. So,
And Casey Manning's playing a character called Joanne.
Alan Bromley gets a lot of blame, doesn't he, for his directing of this story. And you don't know... I mean, you do wonder, don't you, to what extent is he the disaster everyone thought he was, or was he just not very well suited to it, and Tom's rather, I think, selfish tendency to openly take the piss out of someone he's working with just makes it all go bad, really. You can understand if you were saying Alan Bromley was no good at directing actors or, you know, interacting with actors. But the thing that everyone, where they're blaming him, seems to be banging on about is, oh, he was too old-fashioned to understand how all the modern SFX work on TV. But I don't think the SFX are a problem on this. I don't think anyone's saying, oh, Nightmare of Eden is a bit like Dinosaur Invasion, and it's the SFX that really let it down.
Mm.
So I sometimes wonder whether Alan Bromley is the sacrificial lamb here.
Mm.
He directed Time Warrior, by the way, didn't he? And that went quite well. And interestingly, his wife played Fletch's wife in Porridge.
Oh.
So I enjoyed it, but it's not something I would particularly go out of my way to watch again. I would possibly watch it for Tom's performance, but it's not one where I would think, oh yes, that's one of my top five or six Tom performances. It's just, I do think he does very well. I still will stick to this idea I've got. I think he's still possibly the best actor they've had in the role. It's just that I think his nature and how he works with people screwed up his career. I love stuff like, I mean, it's his delivery that does a lot for me. And I don't know if it's a deliberate intention of sounding alien, but he does in a lot of things throughout his era. It's sort of an inventive use of vocal inflection. He'll deliver a sentence where you'll think, oh, I would never have thought of putting the stress on that word or that word. So, for instance, he says, Galactic went out of business 20 years ago, and Tom says, I wondered why I hadn't been paid. Now, I think anyone else would have said, oh, I wondered why I hadn't been paid. But he says it like that, but because he allies it with an almost perfect timing of delivery. The slightly unusual way of saying it sounds alien, but adds to the comedy without being, you know, a bit slapstick. I love that sort of thing.
I'd still like to know where he's been.
Yes, and I'd like to know just who you are.
Me?
Yes.
Well, I told you I'm from Galactic.
Galactic went out of business 20 years ago.
I wondered why I hadn't been paid.
Can I just say that his timing when he delivers lines is excellent, and that's one of the things that I think that works really nicely with him and Romana, with him and Lala Ward as well. I think whatever they've been working on in the rehearsal room, by the time they get it in front of the cameras, it's great. Tom seems to have an innate ability with that comic timing and delivery.
When they say, oh, what's your name and date of birth? I'm called the Doctor. Date of birth? I'm not sure. Sometimes quite soon, I think.
Names and dates of birth. Come on.
Romana.
Romana who? Will you please listen? Someone aboard this ship is smuggling drugs.
Name and date of birth.
Well, how would I know? I don't even know who he is yet.
Your name and date of birth.
Oh, well, I'm called the Doctor, date of birth. Difficult to remember. Sometime quite soon, I think.
Stuff like that, I love it. And which easily makes up for, I mean, you'll see people, when don't people bring up the, oh, my fingers, my arms, my legs thing. But you don't tend to get people saying, what about this marvellous line he delivers? And it's quite well written, isn't it?
I disagree with that.
Oh, what? Go on.
Well, people always go on about the interfere. Of course we should interfere. Always do what you're best at. That's what I say. That's always in, like, so I disagree with that completely. That's the opposite of the my legs, my arms, my everything. And they're both in this episode, or both in this story. Hence why I think it's a slightly erratic performance.
No, but that's what I'm saying. You'll get people saying, everyone who talks about Nightmare of Eden will say something about the my fingers, my arms, my legs, my toes, da, 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 keep moving.
We'll all be merry and bright.
You never find anyone saying, or everyone who comments on Nightmare of Eden always remembers to say something about this brilliant line that Tom delivers. Trista's got a few of them as well, so it must come from Bob Baker.
Trist reminded me of like a Peter Sellers character. Yes.
Yeah. It's very Poundland Peter Sellers.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
But Trist has a few as well. He says, throughout this, Professor Stein.
And you invented this marvellous machine to collect your specimens. You know, I knew a man once who toyed with an idea like this. What was his name? A professor? Professor Stein?
Professor Stein?
Yes.
Oh, a dear friend. He was my mentor. We worked on this idea together before he died, of course. Then we stopped.
Which, that's lovely stuff.
That is funny. It's a great bit of business.
I do have to protest about the... as accurate as it is, the portrayal... I mean, I don't know if Bob Baker was doing a Bob Holmes and had had a bad experience of being expected to pay his taxes like everyone else. But as a former customs officer and excise man myself, I found the portrayal of Fisk and Costa disgraceful, albeit very accurate.
Yeah, I was going to say, surely that's your standard uniform, isn't it? As your...
But you got the doctor saying...
Look out for excisemen. I don't think they like us very much.
Well, that's true enough, actually. Uh-huh. We don't. Romana.
Met such idiots as those customs men.
Idiots? They're worse than idiots. They're bureaucrats. They just exist to tangle people up. Wrap them round and round in red tape until they can't move.
Well, yes, but what's this problem? That's their purpose, honestly. I'm going to leave off for a bit now and let someone else speak.
What about the mantles? Now, here's a funny thing. Now, like I said earlier on, when I was a kid, I couldn't remember my response to the Doctor and Lala jumping through the screen. But I can remember my response to the cliffhanger on episode one. And I don't know, maybe I was very, how can I put this? I don't know. Maybe I was a very highly strung 8-year-old. But I remember that, and that did scare me at the time. Admittedly, now I've got older, I'm staring at it, I'm watching that whole scene, I'm thinking, clearly they're taking that bit of the wall down because they've nailed that bit for them to hold on to. And that's not on any of the other bits. And you could see where it's going to melt around the outside because
you can
see where they patched it up
it's
again.
It's like when Tom's in Deadly Assassin, when Tom's doing his doodling during the court scene, and you can see they've already drawn in very faint pencil the line he's supposed to draw.
Oh, and so I get a bit distracted by that these days. And they do look funny. I kind of love them, though, the mandrels.
I know, but can you imagine kids crapping themselves? What size boat did you fill that night, Mark?
Oh, well, that's just a little one. No, I don't think there was any need for boat filling that night. It was just a... But I do remember being a bit alarmed by it. And also, when they're in the forest of Eden, and they're... Oh, it's the jungle, if you like. And the mandrels are in there as well. I remember finding that particularly scary, because it's quite dark, isn't it? Quite hard to see what's going on. I remember being quite distressed about that. Mind you, I remember season 17 alarmed me a lot. I remember getting scared in Destiny of Daleks when Romana gets cornered at the end of a tunnel by a Dalek. And I remember being absolutely terrified of Verato.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, from The Creature in the Pit, yeah.
Oh,
I was absolutely terrified of. No, because there's that bit, isn't there, where it rolls over him and like he has to. Well, that I don't know why, but that made me sick with horror as a kid. Honestly, that was a boat filler. Yeah, Rato absolutely scared the hell out of me. I don't know. Honestly, watching it now, I can't really explain it, but yeah.
The best rule of thumb is always, isn't it? The less you see of the monster, the more effective they are. I mean, in fact, for quite a while, all we saw of the monsters were these horrific claw marks they left on people's faces, weren't they?
Yeah.
And that was scary enough. But I don't find them too bad. You know, actually, they're not supposed to be baddies, are they? The mandrels.
No, they're not. No, they're not. People say, oh, don't they look cute, though? And it's like, well, you know, some animals look cute and have claws, much like bears.
You know when, at the end of episode one or two, the Doctor and Romana jump into the Eden scene? And I love that too, but they sort of jump over the little threshold thing. And when they're being chased by the mandrels later on, they jump over. The mandrels sort of do this thing where they swing their legs in.
Yeah.
The rearmost mandrel just steps over it. It just kicks up his heel at the back to step over it. And he just looks so much like, oh, that's someone in a costume, that.
Well, yeah, because you can see the zip as well, can't you? Oh, sort of, you on the back as well. Oh, yeah, I can accept that, like I say, there's lots of problems with production. Like when one of the Empress's security guards towards the end drops to the floor and the end falls off the gun.
Yep.
But the mandrels, though, they do look good. I mean, I think they're quite a nice creation, actually. I love because they've got glow sticks in their eyes,
have they?
Apparently.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not, I guess, because they'd get far too warm if it was actual electrically operated lights. Although it looks really good, doesn't it? Those glowing eyes. And I love their little flared legs and stuff.
I think they're a lovely design. I think it's just too easy to say, oh, aren't they rubbish?
Yeah, I guess because they're supposed to be. I mean, they are supposed to be scary, aren't they? I mean, let's be honest. But I love them. What do you think of them, Aidan?
Well.
There's a line in the Tom Baker years, isn't he, where he says one really wanted to take them home.
That was called The Nightmare of Eden. I can't remember anything about it except it was David Dacre. And the German with the silver actor with the German accent was Louis Fayander. And I do remember we did laugh a lot because for some reason the designs of the costumes made the chaps look like, inside it, look like they were in the Muppets, you know, because all the weight was at the top and their legs were very, very pathetic. And also they were very, very friendly. One really, really wanted to take them home. I can't remember much else about that. Let's have another go. But it was funny, wasn't it?
There's like a Build-A-Bear thing in my local shopping centre. And they remind me of that, really. I just think they could have been more effective. Where, you know, the lighting that they have when they're actually in Eden and everything's a bit darker. Yeah. If the ship wasn't as bright as it is, I think they could be made to look a little more menacing.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because they certainly look, they're more effective in the dark of the jungle, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, they are, exactly. So I think it's interesting because I was reading the Wikipedia article earlier on about this, and they said apparently The Sun, as a preview to this story, said the mandrels are going to be one of the scariest Doctor Who monsters of all time.
Oh, man. And John Nathan Turner's not even taken charge yet.
I know. The Sun's told some fibs in its time, but, I mean, the mandrels one is up there, isn't it, really? No, it's what I said earlier about the design of the story is really weak. It's just that they don't look very good. They don't. And they're working with the best as they can. The best moment the mandrel has is when it dissolves into the drug. I can't pronounce it. I can't remember now.
Raxuin. Zip.
That's the one. Do you know, there was an episode of Red Dwarf where there's a compound in that. And I can say that. It's completely preposterous. But the drug in that is cesium francolithic rixielibidium rixidixidoxidexidroxide.
By the sea.
I can say that, but I can't say the one that you just said. Yeah, they're fun for all the family, really, aren't they?
You sound tired.
I mean, you could put them on a conveyor belt, and Brucey could, you know, have a cuddly toy. Oh, a mandrill. Oh, look at the mandrill.
Who was that?
That was my Bernard Manning, if anyone's wondering.
It's like when the master fakes death in The Deadly Assassin. The doctor sniffs the syringe and says, oh, trichophenyl aldehyde. But you can't manage Braxoin. Apparently it was originally supposed to be called xylophilin, which is why when K9 detects it, he says, oh, it's the drug XYP. Because they were going to call it Zip. But they decided that might sound a bit too cool for kids. So they might start taking drugs.
Do you want to try some it? Mark? Mark, have you got any Clarky Cap?
I've got some triple sub.
What?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, come on, you're not my age. I always understand these words. What are you...
These are made-up drugs from a comedy series called Brass Eye from the 90s.
Oh, of course. Yes, cake.
Yes. Hattie Jake's pretentious cheese war.
How do they affect Shatner's bassoon?
Would you like some Chesneck?
This young Czech teenager thought he had a month to watch Nightmare of Eden.
He only had a mid-second to cross the road. Doc, hang on, sorry, Doc, you got some triple sod next to you there.
Behave yourself.
And some yellow bentines. Oh, you're not going to believe this. On the Brass Eye Wikipedia page, it says, an undercover reporter asks a purportedly real-life drug dealer in London for various fictitious drugs, including triple sod and Clarky Cat, leaving the dealer puzzled and increasingly irritated until he asks the reporter to leave him alone. He also explains that possession of drugs without physical contact and the exchange of drugs through a mandrill are perfectly legal in English law.
A mandrill?
A mandrill. I'm not kidding.
A mandrill?
A mandrill is a type of monkey, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think the name of this episode should probably be Vraxoing is a made-up drug.
The whole cake and brass eye issue, listeners, for those of you who don't know, is an episode of Brass Eye from 1997, I think, where they invented a fake street drug to sort of demonstrate how media hysteria can be whipped up so easily. And they got various celebrities and politicians to record sort of campaign messages against it, just clearly having done zero research into this made-up drug. And as ever, faithless listeners, you can find links to photos, videos, and more information on almost everything that we discuss on the Diddly Dum podcast at our podcast blog, which you can find at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. Doctor's best line, as I've said many times on other podcasts, is at the end where he tells Trix to go away. In retrospect, I do think that is possibly spoiled by Tris having his silly German accent. Maybe undercuts that a bit. And I think that's an example where you think the Doctor is more outraged about the zoo than he is about the actual trade in drugs here.
Well, yeah, because he mentions the zoo very early on, doesn't he? And he sort of does this kind of half little laugh, but you can see from the rest of his face that his act is a kind of veiled threat there, isn't there? That laugh doesn't reach the rest of his face. But it works for me.
Tris, thank you very much for your story. Very interesting. We must have a chat about this machine of yours sometime.
Yes.
And about the notion of your capturing alien species for your own private zoo.
Zoo? Yes. No, Doctor, this is important scientific research. I am helping to conserve endangered species.
By putting them in this machine?
Oh, yes.
Ah, yes, of course. Just in the same way a jam maker conserves raspberries.
Thing is, Trist obviously has immense respect for the Doctor. He can tell that he's a man of great intellect. And there's nothing Trist wants more than the Doctor to be impressed by him and to like him. To
absolutely.
Say, well done you. Yes, this is a good thing. You know, yeah, you've done some bad stuff, but I'll let you off. There's nothing he wants more. And so for the Doctor to just be like that with them is, it's like I used to be when my daughters were little. If I got cross with them, I wouldn't shout and get really angry or anything. I would just speak quietly to them firmly and make it very clear that I was very disappointed.
And that in future they should leave your drugs alone.
Yeah, and that's what Doctor does here. And I think it's done wonderfully. And I think there's something about Trist's. And the thing is, Trist still doesn't think he's done anything wrong. He really is justifying everything to himself.
No, exactly, yeah.
And there's something about his comedic accent that makes him almost like a kind of, I don't know.
He's like a pleading little boy, isn't he?
He's like a kind of Labrador in a way. There's something slightly adorable about him. He's kind of all like, oh, ho, ho, enthusiastic about things in a almost childlike
like
manner.
Ken Dodd.
And how did he get in here? And he's not in the Who's Team as well now, is he?
Whoops, wrong episode, everyone. Wrong episode.
Because I kind of like the character. I kind of enjoy, like Doc says, the performance of Trist, because it does add something that I think would add a level of difference and something of note to this extra. And I'd miss it if it wasn't there. But it's... So I think his accent and his sort of dappiness and his willingness to please, I think that works for me.
Doctor, doctor, I didn't want to be involved in all this. Tell them that I only did it for the sake of funding my research. You understand all this? You are a scientist.
Go away.
What?
Go away.
Oh.
I must say, the cabin is full of passengers. Remind me ineluctably of the Starliner in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where they're all being kept hanging around waiting for their complement of small lemon-soaked paper napkins.
But it must have been here for centuries. Hey, man, pass me those four bits of tubing.
What, these?
Yeah. I'm gonna make me a stethoscope and take a listen to this baby. There. And there. Like that.
You hear anything?
Hey. Yeah. Yeah, I can hear something.
What is it?
Oh, Ford. I don't believe what I just heard.
Here, let me listen.
Okay, but you better keep your head screwed on, kid. You can hear.
Yeah. It's a voice.
But can you hear what it's saying, man? Can you get your mind behind what it's saying?
Shh, I'm trying.
Transstellar Space Lines would like to apologize to passengers for the continuing delay to the departure of this flight.
Weird.
We are currently awaiting the loading of our complement of small lemon-soaked paper napkins for your comfort, refreshment, and hygiene during the flight, which will be of 2 hours' duration. Meanwhile, we thank you for your patience. The cabin crew will shortly be serving coffee and biscuits again.
That's how I always imagined it in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, I think that is almost 100%.
Of course!
Douglas Adams, that whole design setup, isn't it?
Oh, brilliant. I've completely forgotten about that. He's the scriptwriter, isn't he?
Yeah. So it's clearly...
Editor, sorry, yeah.
That whole cabin with the Doctor running through it repeatedly, pretending that he's getting through. That's surely Douglas Adams. the way those people are sat there, like reading their magazines and stuff.
Where, yeah.
Identical outfits. He's massively Hitchhikers. And I think it's one of the bits where they've obviously done it to save money. But I think it's genuinely funny.
Oh, I wonder which came first.
Wasn't he writing Hitchhikers when he took over this? Or
no, he was writing the second series while he was... Yeah.
Fit the 12th, which is effectively the final episode of the original radio series of Hitchhiker's Guide, which ends with them meeting the ruler of the universe... was recorded in January 1980. So this was written in January 1980, and this was broadcast in...
late 79, November, December.
Oh, yeah. What do we always say? Doctor Who did it first. Talking of drugs, I was just Googling this earlier today. I came across a review that someone had left on a thread on Gallifrey Base. There was a critical review I've read of Nightmare of Eden. It's happy to serve as propaganda for Prohibition, the worst system of oppression still remaining in the Western world, and its major remaining implementation of a widely accepted bigotry.
Huh?
The Doctor needs to be so vehement about go away because he's on the wrong side. And you need to make lies as big as possible.
What?
I mean, that's a pretty self-explanatory view, isn't it? It's because you'd have to be stoned off your tits to write that, wouldn't you? Right, let's have a look at the... David Dacre. I was thinking of this, and I thought, oh, God. The captain is played by the guy who plays the lead Sontaran in... in Inversion of Time, isn't he? So that sort of this dreadful Cockney accent. I was forgetting it. That's Derek Deadman, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Played Iron. He was in the Sweeney pilot.
Right.
And talking of Time Bandits, he also played Kevin's dad in that, didn't he? And Louis Fiando plays Trist, was in the second Sweeney movie.
Oh, okay. Well, when we get to those, we'll have to keep our eyes open.
He was also in Dr. Fibes Rises Again. So having saved those two Sweeney references for Mark, I don't forget you.
Oh.
Barry Andrews, who played Stott, the guy who has been hiding in the projection for all this time, was in The Spy Who Loved Me.
Doing what?
Oh, yeah, I think he was just one of the submarine crew that had been captured by...
Oh, okay. Love that one. Still doesn't redeem Nightmare of Eden for me, but there you go.
Stromberg. God, that took me a while, didn't it? Jeffrey Hinsliff, who played Fisk, is played Don Brennan, most famously in Curry. He played Jack in Image of the Fendar. He was Claudius as well, wasn't he?
Well, he wasn't.
Yes, true. His co-excise man, Costa, was played by Peter Krays, who's the brother of Michael Krays, who played
Michael
Ben.
Michael Krays, yeah.
And he's also in the Space Museum in the War Games.
Hmm.
Perhaps one of the most annoying things about this series has to be the use of David Brawley as the voice of K-9.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, not good.
So every line he's delivered is as if he's waiting for a round of applause or a gale of laughter after every line from an audience, a studio audience. It's just...
Maybe we should edit some laughs in.
I do that often enough.
Chaps, can you just quickly take a look at... yeah.
What's the joke?
That's from the cake episode of Brass Eye, but it's Bernard. It should be Bernard Manning.
It's Mandrill Manning.
It's Bernard Mandrilling.
Hang on. Am I looking at the wrong photo? Oh, sorry, I'm looking at the one where he's... Did you just do that?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Oh, so this is why Hayden doesn't contribute to the podcast as much as we'd like him to.
That is funny.
Oh, we've got to have that one.
Yeah, yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. I love that. So really...
One mandrill, throw up his own pelvis bone.
Bernard Mandrill.
A really good script. And this is coming, of course, from a man who's about to write 3 Oscar-winning films, isn't he?
Mm. Well, this is true as well. That's why earlier on I said, I don't know how much this was Douglas Adams and how much of it was Bob Baker. As if Bob Baker's not known for writing stuff that's funny. Well, he clearly is. Yeah, I'll take that back.
Well, just as an addendum, I do feel bad every time we do a Graham Williams story that I just basically effectively slag it off. It's... No, sorry, I don't actually. Sorry, now that's a moment of weakness. Carry on. No, I do a little bit, because I don't want to, like, tread dirt over Mark's childhood or your stock, you know.
Look, Hayden, to be honest, I grew up in the 90s where everything I ever read about Series 17 was just people slagging it off. And really, for large chunks of the 90s, or any sort of fandom writing or anything that I came across, it was always people criticising Graham Williams. So, you know, I grew up with that thing. So it was very much accepted opinion when I was sort of in my 20s that Philip Hinchcliffe was brilliant and the worst thing that ever happened was him swapping over with Graham Williams. Mm. And the Philip Hinchcliffe era was just absolutely wall-to-wall flawless bangers. And the Graham Williams era, with the exception of City of Death and Horror Fang Rock, was just a pile of old jank. But that's clearly not the case. But that's what I kind of grew up with. So, to be honest, in a way, I get kind of nostalgic frisson from you slagging it off. It's just like the old days all over again. It takes me back to my youth, Hayden. So, thank you.
It's my pleasure, Mark. My pleasure. It's because I didn't grow up with this era,
I could just
take my fan hat off, and I can even say even the Philip Hinchcliffe era is not very original.
Mm.
You know, I could slag off any of them. Is it Neil, your friend Neil?
Nick.
Nick, that's it. Nick, I hope you're listening, because I'm proving you right here, aren't I, mate?
There's something wrong with every series of Doctor Who.
But there is.
Well, yeah, there is. There's always something goes wrong, isn't there?
Yeah.
No season is perfect, is it? Or is it?
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. For every City of Death, there's a Horns of Nymon. For every Caves of Androzani, there's a Twin Dilemma. And for every Sleep No More, there's Heaven Sent. So, well, the other way around. For every Heaven Sent, there's Sleep No More. But there you go. It's the way it is.
For every Talents of Wing Chiang, there's Talents of Wing Chiang.
Bernard Mandrill.
Bernard Mandrill. So, some of the things they call this loony stuff is...
One boy cried all the water out of his body.
Some people call this Hattie. No, some people call it John Nathan Turner's spunky backpack. One young space navigator was so sick on this stuff, he threw up his own pelvic bone.
Oh, brilliant. No, I love it. Next time I do the Sergeant Pepper's thing for the 200th.
Put Bernard Mandrell on.
Bernard Mandrell's going to have to be in.
Who's this who's come to say his goodbye? It's Bernard Mandrell.
It's like the brain of Morbius, but if Bernard Manning had landed instead of the Doctor, and he takes...
I've been sitting around Eden in my wife fronts, and...
I think Doc's got fed up with us, isn't
he? No, carry on. Have we got anything more we'd like to say?
Constructive to say? No.
Right.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
Let's give it to Mark's out of 10. Mark?
Yes.
Mark's out of 10.
8. Oh, I love it! I love it!
Oh, Mark, you just...
But I do love it. I do genuinely love it. I'm happily going to give it 8. It brings me great joy.
Gentle Welsh Mark. I wish, you know, obviously I love my son to hell, but I wish you were my son as well, because you're just so goddamn lovable. With a mark like that. I would like a mark like that. I'm going to give it a 3.
Oh, I'm going home.
Go to your room, Mark.
Oh, I want to hug a mantle.
I would give it... a 5.5.
Damning it with...
Or maybe a 6.
What's happened to you? What happened to our Doc? I miss jaded and cynical Doc.
I'd give it a 6.
Do you know what? We haven't ever done any season 18, have we?
We're doing too much Tom Baker.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just thinking at some point. I mean, I don't know, we haven't done Tom Baker for 2 years.
Yeah, but even then we did 3 stories of it in that year.
Well, you know, there's a lot to get through.
I think we need to do a modern one.
Yes, we don't go to those often enough, do we? Oh, look who's coming down the corridor. It's Bernard Mandrell, the government's new drug czar. Uncle Bernard, how are you?
I'm disgusted, frankly. I found out that I'm made from a made-up drug. One Czech teenager had a little bit of me, and he was so sick on me, he threw up his own pelvic bone.
Uncle Bernard, we have drug dealers in Sector 20. Oh, you'll never guess what I discovered the other day. You know how in all our farewells for so many years, we've had enemy ships in Sector 27?
It's not.
Do you know it's Sector 47? So I'm going to have to go back over all of them. And
edit them.
And re-record it. So if you find, listeners, next time you log on to iTunes, that you get the last 150 episodes of the Dudley Dub podcast reloading, that'll be it. Uncle Bernard, have you got any advice for us regarding these drugs?
Yeah, dump bodies into the river unless you're a fully qualified water company.
Uncle Bernard, we are drug dealers in Sector 27.
It's a disgrace.
Bye bye, everyone.
See you, everyone.
Bye.
Till next time.
Go on, son off.
Cake first appeared in Prague last year. News reports showed victims insane with pain. Disturbing images like this and a knowledge of the drug routes in Europe led to the formation of Free the United Kingdom from Drugs, incorporating British opposition to metabolically bisterbile drugs. Their single aim, to enlist the great and good...
I'm Bernard Ingham, and this is a piece of cake.
...to warn Britain about cake...
F***ing hell.
...before it was too late.
Hi, this is Bruno Brooks. We all like to party, right? Absolutely. But only the fool would say, yeah, I'll enter the nightmare of cake.
One young kiddie on cake cried all the water out of his body. Just imagine how his mother felt. It's a f***ing disgrace.
Can we lose this thing about the slow crushing of his skull?
No one understood how to get the message over better than this man.
What is cake? Well, it has an active ingredient, which is a dangerous psychoactive compound known as dimesmeric antisense phosphate. It stimulates the part of the brain called Shatner's bassoon, and that's the bit of the brain that deals with time perception. So a second feels like a month. Well, Almost sounds like fun. Unless you're the Prague schoolboy who walked out into the street straight in front of a tram. He thought he'd got a month to cross the street.
And if you're sick on this stuff, you can puke your self to death. One girl threw up her own pelvis bone before she snuffed the lid. What a f***ing disgrace.
Look at that. $100,000 in the pocket of the filth that sells it. A big yellow death bullet in the head of some poor user, or custard gannet, as the dealers call them.
Remember, cake is a made-up drug and has many disguises.
I'm just reading here the names of the f***ing loony stuff. So if someone offers you cake, they might call it loony toad quack.
Russell Dust.
Chronic Basil and Donuts. Joss Eklund's spunky backpack.
Bromicide.
Ponce on the Heath.
Cool Fwax and Charlie.
Argue Barmies.
Or Hatchie Jake's pretentious cheese wog.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting, fitted in your ear.